Emma and Tom Talk Teaching, a podcast about all things education, presented by Emma O'Duher and Tom Breeze. Episode 14, AI in Education, with Carl Jones.
Welcome back, everyone, to Emma and Tom Talk Teaching. And we've got a guest joining us today to talk about a topic that we've been meaning to cover in depth for some time, Tom, haven't we? We're going to be talking about AI in education. And joining us for this episode is Carl Jones. Welcome, Carl. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
And perhaps for our listeners out there, could you just give us a bit of a potted history of your background? Where'd you come from? Where are you now? And what do you do?
Of course. I spent about 10 years teaching in further education. And as part of that, I started to work a bit more in terms of education more broadly. So providing education scrutiny for the borough and then eventually starting to do some work around the curriculum for Wales and with the pioneers there, looking at the transition from what that model might look like into further education, which then led me to initial teacher education at University of Wales Trinity St David for almost 4 years, but now I am here at Cardiff Met as senior lecturer in technologies.
And you work in our shiny new School of Technologies. Yes. Down in Llandaff.
It's lovely campus. With all the toys.
Yes, well, welcome. Welcome to our shiny studio from your shiny school. We've been wanting to do an episode on AI for a while, but we've been looking for somebody who can give us a kind of education angle and a sort of non-sensationalist angle. We see so much out in the media at the moment about how it's going to either, well, first it'll take all our jobs and then it's going to destroy us all, you know. It's loads of fun sensationalising it. But we're going to try and be a bit calmer about it and try and get an education angle. Before we do, in terms of what we're talking about today, what do we mean by AI?
I think when people use the term AI, I think it means a lot of things to lots of different people. And I think for a long time, I think when we would think of AI, people would think of things like Terminator or sentient machines, whereas in the field of computer science, it's a much broader term. And we understand there are different fields in terms of how AI actually operates. So what we look at in terms of AI in computer science is essentially programs at their basic level that can make decisions based on data that is provided. And the way that it does that really is by looking for different patterns or different trends in the data. We obviously see it right now in terms of ChatGPT and image generation with DALL-E and those kinds of things. But these systems exist everywhere already. So when we use Netflix and we go on and we see the programs that are recommended to us based on our previous viewing, those are those recommender models which look at those patterns in what we do. Same if you have a smartwatch or a smartphone and you notice you jump into your car, plug it in the morning and it goes, oh, it's Monday to Friday, you're driving to work and you get those recommendations there. So those are the kinds of systems that are integrated into our lives, but there are some wider applications of those models. And we saw one of them in the news in the past couple of years when we were looking at A-level results and actually predicting. And that's one of the caveats of trying to predict outcomes based on data, is that we have to accept that certain assumptions will be made from that data. And what we saw there was assumptions being made based on socioeconomic backgrounds and your likely outcome in terms of your A-levels. So that's kind of what we think of as our base level of data science, AI decision-making patterns.
And I suppose we need to bring it back into land now, into the context that our listeners will be most interested in, which is education, and in particular the classroom. And I suppose, as with any advancement in technology, it's going to create a bit of a polarising effect. You're going to have some teachers out there who don't want to touch it with a barge pole. You're going to have some that are curious, but maybe a little bit wary, have lots of reservations. You have some who will jump in, probably have already jumped in feet first and are using it and are seeing the benefits. You might even have some out there who are using it and perhaps aren't using it in a critical way and maybe have come up against some challenges. So how, in your opinion, at the moment, is AI finding its way into the classroom? What might we see if we're going into a school and we're seeing teachers who maybe are starting to experiment?
I think through lots of different conversations, I'm seeing lots of ways that teachers are using it to try to cut down on processes that are very time intensive. So you see lots of teachers using it for generating model examples for questions, generating different types of texts when they've already prepared activities, looking at options around helping with planning and those kinds of areas. But that's kind of before you get into the classroom. But there are definitely examples out there of teachers who are using it in the classroom to support learning or get learners to support their own learning using these kinds of models.
Mm-hmm. And for those who aren't familiar with the likes of ChatGPT, the likes of DALL-E, in layman's terms, what do they do? How might a teacher use those platforms?
So in its most simple, and there are lots of steps being missed out in this analogy. The most simple way to imagine how it works is you will type in a specific prompt in there, and you see lots of people advertising themselves as these kind of what I call prompt gurus on Twitter, like, oh, I'll teach you how to ask the perfect question. And what it'll do is it'll take the prompt that you've input and it'll analyze the text and it'll try to establish context. So what you're asking, why you're asking it. And then it'll try to establish weighting based on different parts of the prompt that has been put in there. So try to establish what the importance is. And then through its machine learning, which is a very technical term, I know, is it'll look at this huge, huge data set that it's been trained on. And it'll look for patterns in that data set for what might look like an answer. And I use that expression quite a lot. It looks like an answer. It isn't technically an answer. There's no conscious thought going on there. So it look for those specific patterns and then try to determine what the best patterned answer might look like. In some cases, it's made up. So it'll not be able to generate the right answer just based on the data set that it has. And then there are some issues around the data set itself and some questions that arise in terms of the bias of that data that it's been trained on.
So. And actually, that did come up, didn't it? I remember there being a case a while ago where I think it was Twitter tried to put something in place which would auto-crop pictures that yes. had been put on Twitter, and you would see the sort of thumbnail or the preview on your stream of tweets. And it was a lot better at cropping white people correctly than black yes. people, wasn't it?
And that's a huge issue that we're seeing at the moment in terms of these models, because they're trying to generate things based on patterns. The data set is largely westernized. So we have to accept that when we think about the kinds of answers that we're trying to get, that we're getting answers from a model based on a specific subset of culture and specific groups of people. The way that systems like DALL-E, the image generator, is trying to get around this, which I'm not quite sure of myself. The only way they seem to be trying to approach offsetting this kind of bias around ethnicity or gender is if an individual doesn't specify ethnicity or gender, it'll randomly pop a word in there as part of the prompt to try to offset the bias of the data set, which I'm not sure that that's going to work, really. It's a random generation.
So, I mean, we're already starting here to uncover some of the potential pitfalls, some of the problems that teachers might encounter when they're using these sorts of AI platforms. So I think let's go to one opposite end of the poll then. What's the uproar? What, for those who are dead against it, what kind of arguments are they sort of throwing across the fence at this? And, you know, have they got a point?
I think one of the interesting discussions I saw about this, the BERA conference videos online, there was, I think it's an hour and a half conference video. It's really, really interesting, talking about this whole uproar and the whole issues that we might see ethically. And one of the things that came from that was this term of, we always sort of find ourselves in this area of a discourse of deceit. So the first thing we think of when any new technology comes into play is, how is this going to be used to cheat? And I think that is the thing that lots of teachers will be thinking about in terms of their practice, and I imagine quite a lot of students, about what that looks like. So there's that end of the spectrum in terms of how might this be used to plagiarize, in effect, or to produce work that isn't your own. And I think there is some merit and some consideration that we have to have there. And there's lots of discussions of, if there is a line in the sand in terms of what large language models like ChatGPT should be allowed to do in terms of helping students with our work, lots of people will have that line in a different place. So that's a big issue in terms of looking at things like AI models in terms of generation of work. So that's that one kind of area of, well, what will work look like now? What will we be assessing with these language models? And then this other kind of area is about that kind of essential idea of the bias of the data set. So we have to bear in mind that the decision-making processes, even though they're far more complex with large language models that generate the answers that we get, are essentially based on the same fundamental principles as the decision-making processes that decided that people from certain backgrounds get U's at A-level and people from certain backgrounds get A's at A-level. So we have to bear that in mind.
Here's a question then, and I know you, before we started rolling, you've started talking to your own students about this, haven't you? So where are they drawing the line, and does it align with where you're drawing the line?
I've been accused of being very, very cautious, I think is one of the ways I would describe it. But yes, I was having a discussion with my students about how they have been using it and if they've been using it. And they were quite honest about it. And I think it's because already in their mind, they are in that area now that has this intersection between assessment and these models. So they are starting to form these ideas about what is acceptable. So they admitted to using it as part of assessment, but they all had different ways that they had used it, and they couldn't actually agree on whether the way each other had used ChatGPT was suitable or not. So some people were saying, I've used it to restructure something like a paragraph, but it didn't quite make sense, but those initial ideas were my own. And then somebody else was saying, well, actually, no, you need to be able to get those ideas across yourself. And similarly, in other ways, then, I think one of the ways that people maybe aren't exploring how ChatGPT and language models can be used is that it can go beyond our idea of just written text, because it can program. It can actually write computer programs because it's a language model. It can analyze those data sets. So I think it might also change the way, particularly in the School of Technologies, we might have to think about how we actually assess those skills and what is worth assessing in terms of the changing landscape.
I've certainly thought about this. There's been a lot of hand-wringing, hasn't there, in education about the idea that assessments are suddenly going to have to be thrown out of the window and rethought. And I don't know what you think about this as a cautious AI person, but you look at our kind of oldest universities and they really privilege the tutorial model where, yeah, you know, you do your research, you go and find your stuff out, but then you have to go and have a dialogue with a tutor. You look at level 8, you know, EdDs, PhDs, yes, you write your thesis, but you have to go and have a Viva. It makes me wonder whether actually this assessment not really being that good thing predates the existence of AI. Is it just a bit overdue, really, that we've had this conversation?
I think there's definitely a conversation to be had there. I think I always approach it from the idea of computer science. So lots of examining boards will have an assessment where you're locked in a room for 4 hours, you have no access to the internet, and you've got to write a computer program. Whereas if you've ever written a computer program, you know, the first thing you do is you'll open your programming environment and then you'll open a web browser. It's the first thing you'll do. So I think there is definitely a long overdue conversation about what are we actually assessing. I think when we're looking at, I've had discussions about reflective assessments, particularly in higher level qualifications, where somebody might have put something into practice as part of, say, teaching. I didn't want to give a specific example, but it's part of their teaching. And they've reflected and they've clearly taken something on board from an experience, engaged with some literature, and then applied something that's having an impact on them and their students. But sadly, they can't reference very well, so they're going to get a D. So what is it that we're actually looking at in terms of assessment? So I think you're right, those kinds of conversations and changing how we assess knowledge, I think, is going to be a fundamental part of how we move forward.
But of course, you know, there are a lot of benefits, and you've already given us a hint at how teachers are already using AI in their practice. But, you know, are there more benefits to consider that perhaps we haven't brought to the fore yet in this episode that is worth people being aware of?
Yes, definitely. And I think that something I was very wary about having a conversation and coming across as a Luddite. But I think teaching in particular is a very time poor profession. I think anybody who is a teacher or who knows teachers knows that that is the case. Any way that we can use these kinds of models to speed up those processes that might be holding us back. So things like generating materials that we can use, some examples of things like writing reports where you've got a specific format and you have to change it and you could just be inputting that data very, very quickly. I think those are the kinds of things that are really beneficial. But from the learner perspective, in a classroom environment where students maybe aren't getting a concept in a way and you think, okay, I'd have to come back and revisit this student, coming back to that whole three before me concept, you know, have you asked a friend, have you looked at materials, and then come and have a discussion. Having almost this extra aspect of being able to describe something in a different way, in a way that they might find a bit more accessible, is going to be invaluable in terms of actually being in the classroom. I think as we start to move forward, we'll be seeing things much more along the lines of independent pathways in terms of learning, so where learners can follow specific pathways that are determined by these kind of models that can see progression, suggest how they could improve, give feedback on specific things. But I think coming back to that idea of there are a lot of questions that need to be answered in terms of how these things operate, and just making sure that the people who are using the systems are completely aware of how these answers, how these results are actually generated.
I'm thinking about the fact now you've said here, you know, that the things like large language models can clear away a lot of the donkey work. And you can get down to something perhaps more creative, more interesting. And I suppose it makes me wonder whether some subjects might change more than others. There might be more donkey work to be cleared away in some subjects than others. I also find myself wondering, is there a danger that once you get to the bit where you can be creative, if you don't then break free of those pre-existing data sets, are pupils going to get pushed in the direction of a biased set of data in what they create? Are there ways we can kind of make sure that we consciously break free of that at some point?
So I think that's a really good point, and that's something that I think about, particularly in the context of Curriculum for Wales, when we're making decisions based on our learners in our specific context, that if our first port of call is a large language model, we're already removing that step from our thinking, of our consideration. And we all do it. We all say, oh, we'll generate an answer. And what I'll do is I'll just check it. I'll just make sure that it is suitable or that it is right. But there's so much research in terms of anchor bias, in terms of the first piece of information you receive on anything anchors your thinking, no matter how much you want to try to move away from that. And when you look at research about how professionals in fields operate with that, what they do is they tend to overestimate their ability to avoid that bias. So think, yeah, but I know more than this thing, so I can do it. They are trying to do things to change the responses, so to try to sort of almost level out the bias in the system. So they use feedback from users, they're updating the data that it uses, but I think it's a difficult concept to think of something that can be unilaterally unbiased to all people at all times. I'm not sure how that's going to be approached. So when you think about generating those answers and your thinking, if you're using it for, you've already planned your scheme of work, you've got your lesson plans, you're thinking of your resources, thinking of what needs to be done, and what you're doing is you think, right, for example, I might be using debugging a piece of code, and right, generate five different pieces of code that do this with these kinds of errors. Job done. I think that's a kind of different sentiment to going, I'm not quite sure how to teach this topic, plan my scheme of work for me. And I think, as I say, it's easy to say those things out loud, but then when you get down to the minutiae of it all, where that line is shifts quite a lot. I think we were talking just before the podcast about that idea of the kind of support that you would provide to your students, sitting down and having a conversation in terms of maybe formative assessment, and how you'd be completely fine with that. But the idea of a student using a language model to provide formative assessment themselves almost makes you feel a little bit uncanny about the idea of, ooh, is that cheating? It's like, well, would it be cheating if it was me sitting there doing it? I think those kinds of conversations are the things that we'll be having over the next few years in terms of what we're doing. But the idea of the donkey work of different subjects, I was talking to an art teacher and I was given examples of, oh, well, I would never use it for planning. No, of course I wouldn't. No. And they're saying, yeah, but for art, we have to produce lots of materials in terms of models that can't be generated by these things. They are the important parts. We need to get that off our plate. So I think you're right, that idea of it's not going to mean the same thing to all teachers.
It feels like, and certainly from my own personal perspective, that the fear, the biggest fear around all of this is the erosion of, or the short-circuiting of thinking, of the need to think things through and what that means for our own understanding, our own learning, whether that's from a learner perspective who's being assessed. You know, if they've used ChatGPT, they've short-circuited the thinking. They've got that large language model to sort of do the synthesis for them or to find the appropriate material. So those higher order thinking skills potentially have been lost, yes, or are going to be lost. And the same with teachers. You know, if you haven't really thought through your lesson plan, there's no critical thinking around it, then, you know, do you really know it well enough? Have you, yes, made the right choices by your learners? There's, you know, so much in there: synthesis, analysis, being creative, being innovative. So what can be done to mitigate that? What are the mechanisms that schools could use, that they could be developing amongst their pupils to demonstrate? Is it dispositions? Is it additional skills? They're the right mechanisms that prevent some of those problems, maybe that we won't start to see come out in the wash until a bit longer, a bit later down the line, you know, of a generation of people that can't think for themselves.
Yes, I think it needs to start with a conversation, I think. I think the idea of deprofessionalization is definitely something that's worth considering, because if we do decide that it's okay to get these language models to generate that thinking around planning and teaching, then we're kind of surrendering to the idea of, well, maybe teaching isn't a profession, maybe it is a craft, maybe there is a right way to do it, maybe there is a wrong way to do it, and this model can generate those answers for us. But I think we'll always find that legislation and guidance is always the cart before the horse. We won't receive this guidance in any official capacity until, as you say, it's already ubiquitous in schools and ubiquitous in the way that we work. So I think it's really important, particularly at school level, to sit down and have those conversations. And I think at classroom level, to sit down and have those conversations with learners about what do they feel is an ethical way to use this, and what is the value in terms of the things that we learn and the way that we think about the things that we teach and the things that we expect our students to think about.
It sort of points, doesn't it, towards having a really interesting discussion all the way back to first principles about what is it to be a teacher, what is it to learn, and perhaps with the large language model at the top of my mind, have we disproportionately privileged the ability to put words on a page as a representation of having learned things?
Yes, I think the answer to that is yes, isn't it? I think we have definitely kind of ended up in this era of, well, a level, particularly in HE, a level 6 assignment has this many thousands of words, and that's kind of where we've ended up in terms of how we assess things. And I think we were having a quick discussion before we started about this idea of, well, how do we tell whether things have been generated? And it almost seems like by the time you can start thinking, oh, maybe we could tell this way, the model itself changes, or the way that it accesses information changes. I think we have to think about what is worth assessing and how we actually assess it in our subjects.
Which, of course, could create problems, because discursive, more dialogic methods of assessing are much more time consuming, but they do allow you to sort of get to the heart of, or potentially could, get to the heart of what someone knows, does not know, understands, comprehends, can reflect on. So, I mean, if we're not careful, we've also got a problem where we inadvertently create an even bigger workload for the profession. So I'm still grappling with that thought. I'm not looking for an answer on it, Carl, but that's just my musings.
I think there's the student perspective of that as well. I think I've studied my master's and I'm currently doing my PhD. And I thought, oh, I'm quite comfortable with assessment, but I've recently had my PhD probation panel. And that's obviously a live event where you submit a piece of work that's reviewed and then you're asked questions on not just what you've submitted, but your thinking, your processes, what you plan for the future, defending some of those decisions. And it made me realise that I haven't actually been in that context, even though I think, oh, I've been assessed for years, forever, but I haven't been in a context where I've had to defend something in that way for, I don't want to say how many years, too long. But yeah, it was a situation where I was really uncomfortable. And I think lots of people can relate to that. So that idea of having that form of spoken viva or assessment, again, leads down that road of, oh, then are we disadvantaging a certain group of learners as well if we go down that avenue?
You sort of wonder whether it's pointing to us raising the importance of the process and lowering the importance of the end product, which has tended to be the other way around, hasn't it, quite a lot in assessments?
Yes, I'd say so. I think we see in some of the practical and more vocational subjects, sometimes the process is actually valued a bit more. But in, as you say, in a lot of cases, it is, this is the final thing. Is it any good? It's kind of how a lot of assessment works.
So I suppose the last thing I would ask in terms of this deep discussion is, you know, is there anything that we haven't covered that we need to sort of consider as we move forward that, you know, if you're a teacher in a classroom that you can start to consider tomorrow if you're about to use ChatGPT again, you know, or if you're about to step into using it for the first time? Are there things that we need to consider as we go forward?
I would say if you haven't started using it, it's not going away. And these models aren't going away. In fact, they're just going to change and become far more kind of ubiquitous with our lives. I would say definitely just get on there and start interacting and playing around. But I would say as much as I would advise to be excited by it, go in there with a critical kind of eye around the things that you're looking at. So as I said, they are offsetting these biases in terms of the data. So there's some examples a few months ago that were very stereotypical that they managed to offset. But I was kind of trying to find ways around that, trying to see maybe scenarios where it couldn't quite account for those wider kind of stereotypical aspects. So I got it to generate two learner profiles for students in Wales. I said, right, I want a profile for a learner who is struggling in school and a learner who's doing very, very well in school. And they gave me just these two names, and the one who wasn't doing particularly well was male, and the one who was doing well was female, which is fine. So then I started to generate further profiles. Where do they live? Who are their families? So the male was from Merthyr Tydfil, like myself, and he was struggling in school, and none of his parents were academic in any way. Neither of them went to university. Whereas the girl lived in Aberystwyth, and her parents were doctors. And then I got it to sort of generate the life stories of these two individuals. And the male doesn't go to university, stays in Merthyr Tydfil, which, again, completely fine, based because what we're seeing there is that's based on data. But the female from Aberystwyth with doctor parents goes to university, studies medicine and becomes a professor. So I think we just have to be wary, be very excited. It's super cool. It's going to save us loads of time and it's going to change the way that we do things in the long run. But be very cautious and critical that whatever kind of questions that you might be asking it, the answers are being generated by a model that makes decisions in that way, that it is pattern-based and it looks for those patterns in the data before it responds.
And you've said that this stuff is racing ahead and probably the professional learning for teachers or the regulation or the kind of rules around it will follow long in their wake, probably. So just as a sort of service to our colleagues out in school, should we just clarify one point that you made it at the start? Let's circle back to it, which is that these are things that do one thing very, very well. They are not what the tabloids would have us believe, which is general intelligence.
No, that's right. So even though it is very, very impressive, technically, it is mind-blowing how it's able to do what it's able to do. It's generating these things as it moves along. It's not being provided with these prompts. So it's able to analyze vast, huge amounts of data, generate prompts, and learn from responses to that to improve the way that it generates that data. But that is still what we call narrow AI. It is something that's been designed to perform a single function and for a specific purpose. The idea of artificial general intelligence, which is this kind of next step, and there has been some stuff in the media lately around this about, oh, they almost did it, and some people going, I don't know about that. But lots of papers, there's a working paper, Dylan William and Hattie are working on something, and in there they talk about some of the timelines for what we might be looking at for artificial general intelligence. And some people are predicting as early as 2 years or by 2030. But yeah, that's the kind of intelligence that can actually make decisions in terms of what it's doing and judgments rather than looking at specific patterns.
And that would be a bit of a game changer, wouldn't it?
I mean, you can all put our feet up.
Yeah. Do you have any sense as a tech specialist whether it's 2 years, whether it's 20? I mean, I've looked at this and I just don't know.
No, none at all. Well, I just had to ask Emma how to turn my watch off before we started, so I don't think so.
I wasn't going to out you on that, but since you mentioned it. Oh, Carl, really interesting. I think we could have you back every year and we'll have moved on leaps and bounds and have more to talk about. So maybe we should do that. We'll book you in for a regular slot, okay?
Maybe be ChatGPT, you can have it next year.
Okay, so you're probably aware that we've got our two short slots, something interesting and something to try. I think we've sort of hinted at some things that people could try. Is there anything specific that you wanted to mention?
I think even though you can get on and have a play, I think actually having those conversations with your students in your context about what is not just acceptable for them to be using it for, but what they see as being acceptable for you to use it for as well. So to really start to have those conversations about professionalism, ethics, and those kinds of areas, there'll be no concrete answers, but I think the sooner that we as individuals can start having those conversations with each other, the sooner we can start to establish what might be acceptable for us.
Good one. And something interesting our listeners can have a look at or a read?
So I subscribe to a magazine called Hello World magazine, which is a computing magazine aimed specifically at teachers. So they have different themes every month. So there's one, the Big Book of Computing Pedagogy, but it's not aimed specifically at computer science teachers. So it's aimed at teachers across all subjects. So it looks at computing pedagogy, what it might look like in your specific subject. They've had an issue on AI and sustainability, but this month's issue is specifically on artificial intelligence. So I would very much recommend having a look at that and some of the conversations that are taking place in there and some of the articles and some of the examples.
Lovely. Thank you very much, Carl, for coming and joining
us
on the podcast. Plenty for us to dig into there. Loads for our listeners to have a think about. We hope you've enjoyed it. We'll welcome either you or ChatGPT this time next year. And we'll be back with you in 2 weeks' time. You've been listening to Emma and Tom Talk Teaching, a podcast about all things education presented by Emma O'Duher and Tom Breeze. The special guest this episode was Carl Jones from Cardiff School of Technologies, and thanks to Carl for taking part. Podcast artwork is by Beth Blandford and the music is by Cameron Stewart. The studio manager is Adrian Rapps. We're on X at Talk Teaching Pod if you want to come and say hello. We'll be back in a fortnight with something else interesting. Until then, take care and enjoy teaching.